Hello and welcome to another edition of the Reading Muslims podcast, the Fiqh and Qahwa series with myself, your host Anwar Iman, and my guest and colleague and friend Muhammad Fadl, both of us as professors here at the University of Toronto in the Faculty of Law, specialists in Islamic law, considering in this series really thinking hard about issues of textuality relative to the study of Islam and Islamic law. This is the third in a series, and we've really been focusing a lot on the training that has been and continues to be part of the story of Islamic legal scholarship, and the idea of positionality, the location of the scholar as and their subject, his or her subjective self in the context of a scholarly production. Today's session, we're going to focus on the what's of reading. And so, Muhammad, let me just open with a question. But before we do that, just want to welcome you to our third installment. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you. You're very welcome. I've enjoyed this tremendously.
So, Muhammad, recently you released Al-Muwatta in a translated form. You worked tirelessly on the translation of Malik's Muwatta into English. And let's face it, it's a real service to the field. But as you know, it's not the kind of project one undertakes, certainly not pre-tenure, given the current incentive models in universities today. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you got into the project, the process that you undertook, and most importantly, why it was important for you as a scholar of Islamic law to help lead this particular endeavor.
One word, guilt. I'm kind of half joking, half serious. I was kind of guilted into this project. The project was not my idea. It had started in Morocco. If one wants to go back to its earliest roots, in the early part of the first decade of this millennium, when the King of Morocco commissioned a group of scholars to produce a critical edition of the Muwatta, based on, some very ancient North African manuscripts. And when that project was completed, it was then suggested, then let's produce an English translation of it. The person who translated that is Connell Manette, who is the chief editor of the volume. He is actually a PhD from PhD of University of Toronto, Medieval Studies. And he had taken a job in Morocco at Al-Akhawain University in religious studies. And so it was part, the idea was to translate the Muwatta and use this in connection with interfaith commitments of the Kingdom of Morocco, as well as the Kingdom of Morocco's general religious education program to non-Moroccans. So Morocco has a very active kind of religious missionary program, one might say, particularly in Western Africa and in Europe. And it was seeking to sort of maybe leverage this new edition of the Muwatta into English speaking zones of Islam. And so they decided to commission an English translation of it. They began doing it. And then they realized that they really needed somebody with expertise in Maliki fiqh to participate. As originally crafted, the translation team was a couple of Moroccan linguists who are very good, but didn't really have any legal expertise. And they found me. And I was basically convinced this is a really important project. It's not going to take you a lot of time. You're not going to really have to translate it because we've got these translators. All you're going to do is edit it, review the translation. And so I agreed. And then when I got into it, I realized that the editing would be more like rewriting from beginning to end, not because the translation was necessarily wrong, but it was often very awkward. Sometimes it was wrong because they weren't sensitive to the legal technicalities, but most of the time it was just very awkward English. And so essentially I had to do the translation all over again. Now, as it turned out, it was a very serendipitous project for me, because even though I had obviously used the Muwatta in my research, I actually never read it as a text. And so I ended up, as a result of doing this translation, reading it maybe three or four times from cover to cover, as well as consulting various commentaries in the course of the translation. So I felt like I really learned a lot, not only in terms of substantive jurisprudence, but also about the Muwatta as a book, as a unique book and its place in Islamic legal history. And I would have never done that if I'd never done the translation.
Can I follow up on something? Because you made a really interesting distinction that I want to point out for our listeners, is that you'd read the Muwatta in the past, but never cover to cover as a book. Can you elaborate? Because that's a really interesting distinction in reading practices that you identify. Could you elaborate more on what you mean by that? What does it mean to read it the way you had before, and then later to read it as a book, cover to cover?
Yeah. So before, I just use it as a reference. So if I were curious about a particular doctrine, I might look and see if there's any kind of reference to it in the Muwatta, and then, you know, find it there and just look at that particular report or something in isolation without real concern for the overall structure of the book, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I had plenty of citations in the Muwatta in prior articles and things like that, but, you know, in the way of a reference, as opposed to a book, trying to understand it as a book, right?
And then my next question is, what does that mean at the end, once you have read it as a book, sometimes two or three times cover to cover, how do those earlier doctrines that you might have identified and looked at, maybe in isolation, do they read differently? Do you come to a different conclusion about them? Or what's the nature of your sense, what's your sense of the book as the book then, back to look at those citations?
What I came to realize was that, at least the way I view it, Malik, I think, understood what he was doing in a way radically different than the way later users used the book. So Malik was actually trying to make very particular arguments about particular things, and was constructing the book, arranging the materials, arranging the chapters with a particular aim in mind. Whereas modern readers, not even modern readers, even let's say post-classical or post-classical readers, they began to mine it as data points. And you can see this in the history of the commentaries. So, you know, as I tried to mention in my introduction to the translation, the text is about 50-50 jurisprudence in the sense of ra'i and precedents, whether they're prophetic precedents or companion precedents or successor precedents, right? But the distribution of these precedents is not even throughout the book. So some chapters have a lot more precedential material, and other chapters have a lot more just pure juristic reasoning material. Yeah. Some chapters have a lot more concentration of prophetic reports than others, right? And so a Maliki commentator like Al-Baji, he's really interested primarily in the ra'i, in the juristic opinions of Malik. Somebody like Ibn Abdul Barr, also a Maliki, you know, he ends up writing three commentaries on the Muwatta, which reflects these three different concerns of later generations. So one, at Tamhid, is all about the Muwatta as a hadith book. His other book, Al-Istithkar, is all about the Muwatta as a fiqh book. And then he has a third commentary, which is purely concerned with establishing the validity of all the prophetic hadiths that are in the Muwatta. And so, and then when you go beyond that, later commentators seem to focus only on the hadith. So if you look at Suyuti's commentary on the Muwatta, he skips everything that's not a hadith. So it just becomes a source of hadith for later scholars, particularly if they're not Malikis. Even a late Maliki like Zurqani, his commentary typically is limited to the prophetic hadiths that are in it. He doesn't spend a lot of time commenting on the long discussions of fiqh. So, you know, as we get further away from Malik and closer to our period of time, it loses its status as a fiqh book and becomes more and more of a hadith book. And that's how people today think of it. They think of it as a hadith book. They don't think of it as a fiqh book, but Malik thought of it as a fiqh book.
So does that mean that now, for instance, after having gone through this with Malik's Muwatta, do you approach fiqh books with a sense of the whole? Like, how does it? How have your own reading practices around fiqh changed as a result? I of course, think of them and oftentimes have used them, like you, to pinpoint an issue, look at the doctrine, and move on, almost in encyclopedic fashion. But what you're suggesting is that as we look at the book as a whole, there's something else going on. And so how is it affecting, after having done this with Malik's Muwatta, how is it affecting the way you read now?
Well, I wish I could say I'm reading enough to be able to say that it's radically changed my reading habits. But, you know, I am, you know, I'm trying to go back and revisit my dissertation in the hope of publishing it. And so I'm rereading Tafsirat al-Hukam, this treatise on adjudication. And one of the things I'm trying to think about is, why does Ibn Farhun write this, you know, really big treatise on adjudication, very, very detailed, while at the same time, we have a longer term development in legal writing of the abridgment, the Mukhtasar. And he was certainly familiar with it because he wrote a very popular commentary on the abridgment of Ibn al-Hajib. So on the one hand, you have this consolidation of, let's say, black letter law through the phenomenon of abridgments, of which Ibn Farhun was very much a part and participant. Then at the same time, you have him writing an encyclopedic work on two or three chapters of the overall fiqh enterprise, right? So if you think that the whole process of abridgment is to make the law more accessible and more transparent and easier to find, then what's the point of writing this encyclopedic treatise, right? And so I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I'm kind of thinking now, oh, it's kind of like the equivalent of Wright and Miller in federal procedure. If they're familiar with American law, you know, you have this multi-volume work on the intricacies of federal jurisdiction and federal procedure that go all the way back to the founding. So it contains a bunch of stuff that's not necessarily good law anymore, but it's comprehensive. And so I kind of think that's what is going on with Ibn Farhun's work on adjudication, because even if he includes cases and opinions that don't represent the going opinion, I think the idea very simply is you can't really understand the going opinion unless you understand the alternatives to it, right? But yeah, I'm like you, most of the time I just try to pick a book and try to find what does it say about X. But let me give you another example, the Mustasfa of Ghazali. So, you know, again, lots of times if I'm interested in an usul question, like, you know, I put together a bunch of notes on the question of ijtihad and the ontological status of rules based on ijtihad. And so I just did sort of like the straightforward thing. I went to the chapter on ijtihad and like seven or eight different authors and, you know, took notes on what they had to say and the status of the hukm, et cetera. Do they believe there's one right answer or, you know, whatever. And so when you do that, I mean, it's not a bad way of reading. In many ways, it's a very good, productive way of reading. But you do sometimes miss maybe a larger point of the work and the uniqueness of the work. So for a couple of years, I've been doing a reading group with some grad students here in Usul al-Fiqh, and we read a couple of different chapters from al-Mustasfa. I think Am wa Khas and Nasr, I can't remember. But anyway, what I began to realize was that I think a big portion of al-Mustasfa can only be understood as a criticism of a different strand of Shafi'ism that Ghazali thought was dogmatic and ultimately intolerant in a way that was socially dangerous. Because as you know, of course, there's a lot of Shafi'i Hanafi rivalry. And he ends up defending the reasonableness of many Hanafi positions in al-Mustasfa as against his interlocutor, whom I believe to be Abu Ishaq al-Shirazi, who he always sort of badmouths as being kind of a simpleton. And so you might not realize that unless you read a lot from a particular book. So you might not see what's unique about the book when you just go look at certain topics.
No, that's fair. That's fair. That's a great observation. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. I'm almost tempted, because I have a couple more questions, but you know, I'm almost tempted to go right into to leapfrog one of them and come back to the other one. Was, do you have a favorite pre-modern author? Is there a favorite book that you like to, that you just feel attached to? I mean, I worry that it's going to be the Muoto, in which case then there's not a whole lot more to say, but I'm wondering, do you have one?
No, not really. I mean, I think there's a lot of fun in discovery, because you don't necessarily know what you're going to find until you start looking. And this is, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier about the post-classical period, for a long time, there was just an assumption that everything was the same. So there's no point. And we just haven't done enough work reading post-classical works to be able to say that with any confidence. I mean, just looking at Maliki commentaries on Khalil, for example, you know, there is a lot of repetition for sure, but there's also different approaches to commentary. And so until you actually take the time to look and read at these, read these different works, you can't know what's in them. Right.
Well, let me ask you then, because this is a perfect segue to my next question, because, you know, for me, certainly what makes Islamic legal texts such a remarkable sort of genre for research is just the range of traditions, moves, innovations. As just again, the artfulness of the things that we discover and the surprises there. So I'm wondering if you could take our listeners through just a certain sort of mental map of topics that you, when you write about, how do you decide? How do you, Muhammad Fadl, make a decision given a topic that you've decided on? What's your bibliography? How do you determine the sources that matter for your work, given the rather large and sometimes kind of overwhelming archive of Islamic literary texts?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think there's a lot of path dependency here. I mean, so I can only talk about my experience. So when I was a grad student, I decided to study Islamic law and do my dissertation on Islamic law. You know, I had to start somewhere. So I started with this book called The Sharh al-Saghir at the recommendation of my friend and colleague, Professor Sherman Jackson, and because he had studied that. And so I checked it out from the library and I tried to read it, and I could literally make no sense of it because, it, you know, it's a very late text, very terse, hot, you know, highly structured according to the conventions of the late or the early modern taqlid tradition. And so I studied with a teacher. I found a teacher in Egypt. I started reading it. I ended up reading the entire text except for maybe, I think, the chapter on Hajj and the last chapter called Kitab al-Jama, which is kind of a grab bag of things. But that was really important because what that did was first it gave me a conceptual map of what kind of topics were found in fiqh and a rudimentary understanding of the doctrines so I could kind of understand the different issues. But then it also, and this is one of the great things about the late tradition and the commentary tradition, is it gives you lots of names of people and lots of books. So you can sort of see who the late authorities consider to be authorities.
Okay. Right? Yeah, sure.
And so again, there, you know, Ibn Farhun would come up frequently. And so I thought, okay, if I want to write courts, I should go look at Ibn Farhun. And so then I got that. And then Ibn Farhun just cites so many different people, right? So it's kind of like you can think of, you know, Russian dolls. You open one and you get another. And so it kind of, the bibliography kind of produces itself as you read, because, you know, it's like the citation problem. You go to a footnote, and then that refers to something else, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of the, you know, that, you know, what to look at in terms of the Arabic archive. The more difficult problem, I think, is trying to figure out the proper theoretical perspective to bring to bear on your materials. And so here, you know, ever since I was a grad student, I've tried to read in sort of analytic jurisprudence, I guess, you know, Hart, and now I can't remember his name now, Fuller, these people, to try to get a certain kind of conceptual architecture to bring to bear to my materials. Like one of the things that I think, not to pat myself on the back, but I think one of the things that I did in my dissertation, which was kind of, I think, an innovation, was to use Hart's idea of the rule of recognition to understand what was going on in post-classical FIP and show how it changed from classical FIP. And I realize now that I probably, that it was a right move, but it wasn't sufficiently sophisticated. Like I could do a much better job of explaining the rule of recognition and what it's supposed to do, et cetera. And, you know, I think that's important because otherwise you could make the mistake as a reader to assume that all that Ibn Fahrhun is doing is listing, you know, every single opinion that exists and that they're all equal, right? And so you have to understand this idea that a rule of recognition existed. So if you're not reading in theoretical jurisprudence or the philosophy of law, it's not as easy to interpret your material. At least that's my opinion. Of course, you know, some people thought that was an illegitimate use of theory.
Or anachronistic, and maybe even.
Right, not necessarily anachronistic, but just the idea that you shouldn't be using non-Islamic theoretical methods to analyze Islamic law, right? Now, I'm willing to defend that choice, but people criticized me for that.
Yeah. Well, what do you think now? I mean, obviously, it's very difficult to imagine the Islamic Legal Studies Academy without, on the one hand, sociolegal studies, which is its own theoretical framework, or even some of the kinds of debates that we saw happening between Hart and Dworkin, or even Fuller. And so do you think that we're past that point, or are we still contending with that? Because it's been something that you brought up earlier in one of our earlier podcasts around training, and the theoretical framings come up here again. So I'm wondering where you think the field is relative to this other dimension of scholarship that's not neatly within NELC departments, maybe is more within legal academies, but nonetheless has been prominent in this podcast, but also in the field more broadly.
I just think it's very important for us to be more theoretically sophisticated in the sense that we should try to understand the theoretical context of the method that we're applying. I mean, oftentimes we just do things assuming it's part of common sense, not realizing the theoretical roots to these commonsensical ideas. So I'll give an example. Lots of people who write casually about Islamic law, historians, political scientists, oftentimes adopt what I would call a crudely Austinian positivist model of law. And then they think that Islamic law doesn't match that model. And so then they assume it's not really law, right? And I say, well, thank God it doesn't match that model. But you need to really have a better idea of the frame that you're using. I'm perfectly fine to deal with an Austinian positivist, but at least make explicit the way you're using it and don't just assume that this is the only way of understanding what law is, right? And so same thing with sociolegal studies. It's just helpful. It just makes the work a lot better if one is aware of the theoretical premises one is using and recognizing why some people might find them controversial. You know, there's no requirement that everybody accept your theoretical premises, but you shouldn't be unaware that you're using controversial theoretical premises in your
work. That's fair. Well, this brings me to my last question for today, and then we'll bring it to a close. But it really comes back to some of the questions core to the issue of Reading Muslims, one of textuality. As you know, Reading Muslims centers questions of textuality in the study of Islam. And you also know very well that the Islamic literary tradition is vast, spanning fields like history, theology, law, just to name a few. But, you know, part of what the theory conversation we're having right now and Reading Muslims is also exploring is how do we determine within the body of texts what is and is not a legal text? For Reading Muslims, it does raise a question. When is a text legal? And when is it not for purposes of Islamic law?
So
how do you approach that? How do you approach demarcating the genre of the Islamic how do you within the larger archive of Islamic literary text demarcate genres of Islamic legal literary texts?
It can be difficult, particularly in the earlier periods. When genera were as strictly defined. But I just finished writing a draft chapter on the history of Islamic international law. And in discussion of sources, I mentioned this as a problem that for the early period, it's not quite clear whether a work should be viewed as a work of history or as a work of law. Particularly in when you're dealing with international relations, law of international law, because many of the precedents are supposedly historical, involving actual events like sending an ambassador or a battle or treating prisoners after a certain thing, right? And so what I ended up saying was that I would consider work to be historical where the author seems to be organizing the material based around just trying to establish what happened, right? Whereas a work is legal if it's organized around particular questions of law. And so a work like the Mudawwana is clearly law because it's all based on legal questions. But the work that I was sort of, and I said was ambiguous, is something called Sirat al-Fizari. I think his name is Sirat al-Fizari. I can't remember exactly his name. But he was a colleague of al-Wazai. He lived in the Levant along the Byzantine frontier. And he published a book. He compiled a record of precedents, right, that were relevant to the wars between the early Muslim state and the Greeks. But there's really not much legal commentary, and it's just, this happened, this precedent. So I would say that's kind of a borderline case. And then, like, you have a book like Kitab al-Amwal of Abu Ubaid ibn Salam. And again, there, it seems to be a collection of precedents with no attempt at systematic legal analysis, right? And so I would say it's more historical, even though it's all the precedents have legal ramification. After all, the book is called Kitab al-Amwal, the book of property and taxation. So it certainly has legal significance, but it's organized as a history, right? Presumably the same thing can be said about even the history of Tabari. I mean, because he's got the history of the Prophet and the early caliphs and all that is relevant data for the jurists, right? So it's kind of a matter of, the way the author organizes the material. Later on, it becomes, I think, much clearer, right? Because now you have a distinct tradition of legal writing. So, the Malikis begin to, they start commenting on the Mudawwana, they reorganize it, etc. Same thing with the Hanafis, right? And so there's a much sharper break between law and mere preservation of historical events, precedents, right?
it does seem, and I think it's fair to say that, you know, a lot depends on the period. And so I think you've raised a really important point about, you know, the legality of a text really also depends on how, on the markers of legality as they themselves have evolved over time, with these, this earliest tradition being the most challenging one to locate. So I think that's, so no, thank you very much. I want to bring our podcast to an end by thanking Dr. Fadl for joining us today here on the Reading Muslims podcast, and tune into our next and final installment shortly, where we'll be talking more about the hows of reading, thinking about the techniques and the modes of reading and the kinds of questions that have historically and continue to be asked of the tradition. So thank you for joining us. Thank you for being here. And thank you, Dr. Fadl. And we'll look forward to seeing you next time.